Has Lance finally learned something from Fernando? And why is Andrew so tired of the Dutch national anthem? Welcome to Tinfoil Helmets, your occasional spicy hot take roundup of the latest F1 rumours, all with almost believable conspiracy theories to back them up. Everything here is carefully researched for hours to make sure it's totally founded in logic, reason, and truth. Or not. Who knows? Shall we start off with, have we got anything right?
I got some stuff right. Your predictions, even during the race, were just wildly all over the place.
Apparently my random number generator is very random.
Yeah.
So number one, we had a prediction that it would rain.
It did. FP2 was rainy.
I will allow that, although I feel maybe we were implying it would rain during a bit that mattered.
If you go play back the other podcast, I very clearly said rain in any session.
Okay. Okay. I will concede that point.
Yeah. I was hedging my bets.
Yeah, I don't want to rain on your parade. But my prediction was Max has another DNF, and sadly, I was wrong.
No. Max definitely finished, although we didn't see a lot of him on the TV broadcast.
No, if I was the sponsor who'd paid rumored, three-year contract, Oracle of $300 million, I'd be kind of upset because we didn't see either of the Red Bulls for basically the entire race.
Yeah, well, this is like the thing. If you want to provide good value, you have to be a good midfield car at this point in time.
Yes, or you have to, as someone who is being sponsored and is at the front, you need to turn it down a little bit and pretend like you're actually racing the other drivers.
Oh, no, yeah. What was it? Who was the color commentator? Was it Anthony
Davidson?
Yeah, don't like him. But he made a comment like before the start of the race of like, oh, everybody thinks Max is going to like go off into the distance, but Checo's been nearly as fast in every session. It's like, okay, Ant, nearly as fast is not as fast nor faster in any session. And guess what? Max just went off into the distance.
And he didn't even have to try. But we'll save that for the race. Next prediction on our list. I can't remember. Was this me? It must have been me because it's stupid. Carlos is on for another win, but Ferrari screw the strat. I'm going to give myself 0.1 here because he was doing pretty good. Carlos was, I think, the best driver that they had this weekend.
That's true, but I was going to go so far as to say that Ferrari look like they actually know how to run a strat right now.
I have to believe that this was just merely the phases of the moon and the sun. Like, we're getting the apocalypse. I mean, it's the solar eclipse on Monday. It has to be something about that because there's no way that this could be the way that it's going to keep going.
Yeah,
that's
not possible. Between Mercedes not knowing how to have any strategy and Ferrari running the best strategy, what universe are we in right now?
I'm concerned. This means many of the things are going to go wrong.
We also had Williams run only one car. I'm calling this one pretty much true.
Does
three corners count as a race? I don't think so.
I don't think it counts either.
I don't think Alex broke even a sweat.
No. And apparently it's cost them $2 million in crashes this year, so that's not good. I said there was an outside chance that Merck only run one car, but they decided to give it to George. No, but George was basically the only car that they cared about.
That's true, but that's been true for a little bit.
Yeah. And then last but not least, Daniel in the points. We totally missed that one.
Daniel totally missed that one.
I know I'm fast forwarding, but man, watching his start before the bouncy bounce part was ridiculous.
It was not a great start.
No. Would you care to explain the score? Because I still don't understand it.
Well, we have out of our 18 predictions, we have gotten 8.5 correct.
Okay.
But with our half credit, which means we are batting 472.
Is that 0.472?
Yes.
Okay, can we put the point in front of it? Because it's very confusing for me. I was like, how did we get to 472? Are we giving ourselves like 25 points? Is this like F1 points where it's just ridiculous?
Exactly. And hey, we're staying well above the Mendoza line, so that's good.
What's the Mendoza line?
In baseball, there was a player named, I forget his first name, Mendoza. And he was such a terrible hitter. I think he batted like 180 or 190, something terrible. But he was such a good defensive player that it made up for how terrible he was batting. So there's this comment of like the Mendoza line is where you are not batting well enough to justify how good you are in the field.
I see. Is it also a great example of how statistics can deceive?
Yeah, sure. That there is more to player value than just batting average.
Indeed. That's why we keep Charles Leclerc around.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, but what is he batting on pole positions to win? Not great.
No, not great at all. He's all right as a second driver. They can keep him. Between race drama?
I mean, I think if we really... The most drama... Between race drama, the most drama we had was the addition of the chicane going into the Arenberg Forest at Paris-Roubaix. That had to be the most drama I've seen in a long time.
You're going to need to provide some color here.
All right, awesome. So... This is the final week of the Cycling Cobbled Classics. You have last weekend would have been the Tour of Flanders or the Ronde van Vlaanderen. And then this weekend is, hey, that's the best Flemish I got. And then this week is Paris-Roubaix, which is a fantastic race. It used to be from Paris to the Roubaix Velodrome, and now it's from outside of Paris to the Roubaix Velodrome. But essentially, they found all these terrible cobbled roads that sometimes date back to, like, Roman days. And unlike other bicycle races where it's like, oh, how fast can you go over this steep, short, punchy hill? It's really how fast can you ride over the roads we've been able to find. And one of the most famous ones that is 90 kilometers out from the finish line, it's one where you won't win the race on this sector, but you will lose it on this sector, is mm-hmm. the trench at Arenberg, or the Forest of Arenberg. And normally the run into this thing is like 40 miles an hour, and that leads to it people getting hurt just because you suddenly hit this very rough section of cobblestones and people fall and break things that we don't want them to break because you're running into this thing at 40 miles an hour.
That sounds unpleasant.
So, yeah. So this year, they added a chicane going into Arenberg to slow everybody down.
So the chicane is on the smooth part before the cobbles?
It's on the tarmac, yeah.
Okay. And did it work?
It did. It did. Slowed everybody down.
Okay. So no injuries due to the cobbles?
Nope. And Matthew Vanderpool pulled off the Flanders-Roubaix double for the first time since Tom Boonen did it in 2013. And Matthew Vanderpool is, in fact, Dutch. So if you are a F1 and cycling fan, you could not escape the Dutch national anthem this weekend.
That's beautiful.
Yes.
I do have an important follow-up question. Since there are cobbles,
yeah,
do the bicycles have suspension?
No.
Not even a little soft, squishy one on the seat?
Definitely not a soft, squishy one on the seat. There have been some teams that have dabbled with like some weird dampers in the forks over the years.
Okay.
It's very interesting. Yeah. But even
because the weight trade-off seems like it's not a good trade-off.
No. It's
interesting.
Paris-Roubaix tech has been very interesting, especially over like the last 10 years, as like we've gone just to wider tires all around and aero bikes all around. Because it used to be like there was specialty equipment for like everybody like 10 years ago. And these days it's like... Like, looking at what Vanderpool was riding, it's like, yeah, that's just your normal bike at this point. Like, which is also a testament to just how good modern bikes are.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating. How many people's bikes fell apart as they went over the cobbles?
I don't know. I don't see the number. But there have been some really good ones in the past.
Yeah, I can imagine, like, bounce, bounce, bounce. Oh, there goes half the up tube, front column thing.
Yeah, the worst of which is there was an American named George Hincapie who loved Paris-Roubaix and always wanted to win Paris-Roubaix. And I think in 2005 or 2006, his aluminum steer tube detached from the carbon fork. So there's just this video of him suddenly without his hands on the bars as he goes careening into a ditch and breaks his collarbone because his bike fell to pieces.
I assume lots of people have suddenly remade this video with the Benny Hill music.
I don't think so. I hope not.
Okay, maybe not. Okay. That would be too insensitive.
It would be a little insensitive.
Okay.
But Paris-Roubaix, always a great race.
Okay. The only other related possible bit of race drama, and I'm not really sure this is drama, was Alonso after we recorded last week. He got a 20-second penalty for brake checking, and I would like to point out to the listeners there are significant air quotes here, brake checking George, and then using the force to send him off the track.
Well, actually, I think the real drama was they ran into each other at a coffee shop in between the races.
Because they're going to be teammates next year.
Probably. Maybe. Maybe not. But anyway, but that he was asked about that at the press conference on Thursday. And it's like, have you talked to Fernando? It's like, well, we ran into each other at the coffee shop.
And then Max says, did you brake check him?
Yeah. I I really want to know what George's real answer to that question was, because if you go watch the video, he's like, I feel like he wanted to punch him in the face or something. Like, it was very clear. He was like, I was pissed. I was livid. Like, he was trying to just, like, be very, like, nice, political about it. It was very interesting.
Every time George opens his mouth to answer a question, he gives a political response, and it's really getting old.
Yeah.
It's terrible. Even when the other drivers do it, it just doesn't sound as bad as when George does it. George needs to go back off. He needs to go and get on off media training. Give him some personality.
I really feel like Max runs that thread very well of, like,
yes,
not necessarily not giving the political answer, because he's been very diplomatic with a lot of his answers, but he definitely is very lighthearted in his comments.
Yeah, and especially as you know, the stereotype of the Dutch is that they are direct. You'd have expected him to put his foot in it more, and he does actually a good job of threading the direct with not putting his size 12 shoes in it and making a whole mess of it. So, shall we see if anybody still has a job in our very occasional, very rare segment? Danny Rick. Did you see the brutal cut when he spun that cut to Liam?
Oh, no.
This was, I think, in one of the, I think it was in Quali. He spun off the track and got it back going. But the moment he spun, the director immediately cut to Liam in the garage. It was brutal. Brutal.
I think this is a weekend that helped Daniel Ricciardo save his seat. Because Yuki qualified 10th, Daniel qualified 11th. Yeah, one made Q3, but they were going to be next to each other on the grid, pretty much. And it's Yuki's home race, so, like, a lot of good vibes for Yuki.
The half a second advantage.
Yeah, a lot of good vibes for Yuki. So, you know, I think Daniel did a very good job of being close, but then, you know, he had that terrible start and he got tagged by Alex. I think Alex was at fault. I think it was kind of a racing incident, but I think it was a little bit more on Alex because, you know, they talked about during the red flag period, they were talking that, like, yeah, Daniel was just kind of going for the racing line. And I think you kind of have to assume if you're Alex that the guy in front of you is going to go for the racing line, especially with where Lance is and how tight that whole section is. So I put it a little bit on Alex compared to on Daniel. But so I think, if anything, I think just buys him another week.
Yeah, I think he needs to. I think he's definitely in danger of losing his seat midseason. Is this going to turn the second Red Bull team seat into a curse?
Well, I mean, there's the curse of being Max Verstappen's teammate, however, Perez is doing pretty well this year, we have to be honest.
So far.
But granted, the first four races weren't his problem last year either.
Exactly. So yeah, Danny Rick, I'm not sure. I think it's looking a bit sus. How about Mr. Stroll back in the game?
Oh man, more like back of the field. I know I sent you the TikTok, but there's like some streamer who was playing the F1 game and he was driving a Mercedes and he's like, oh yeah, we gotta be on pole. We gotta be on pole. This is gonna be so good. 16th! And I just have to imagine that's gotta be how Lance was feeling.
Yeah. What was so curious is he had the new car for longer. Fernando seems to have capitalized on the new car and seems to be pretty good with it, even though he got it late. But then in the race, it looked like Stroll was actually doing a pretty good job of doing some overtakes and got some motion. And despite coming on the radio and complaining about the GP2 engine in his Mercedes-powered car.
This is moving a bit forward, but at the same point in time, he put on soft tires to try to catch Yuki and overtake Yuki and ended up getting passed by Hülkenberg, I think. One of the Haas.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, like at the end, they pitted, put on soft tires, tried to chase down Yuki, was chasing down Yuki, did a good job chasing down Yuki, and then burned out the tires and lost so much time that he ended up losing the spot to the Haas as well. Now, granted, 11th and 12th, who cares, because there's no points, but morally, it's not a good look.
It does matter at the end of the season when you are, you know, doing the count backs and trying to reconcile it. That position does make a difference in how much money you get. Yeah. It's going to be a shame for whoever has to be Stroll's teammate in 2026 and 2025.
I mean, it could just be a whole new lineup, let's be honest.
No, because nobody's going to fire Mr. Stroll, because he's perfect in every way.
Honestly, if Fernando moves teams, that could be the best thing to keep Lance's seat.
Yep.
Because if Lance stays, you know, is Yuki going there? I don't know. Like, we've talked about other drivers going there, but it's, yeah.
Speaking of Fernando and seats, did you see the quote that he did when he was asked after the race? He was like, so have you been talking to Mercedes about moving to Mercedes? Are you interested in moving to Mercedes? And he was like, No, they're slower than us. Why would I go to Mercedes? Which I thought was particularly brutal.
He's got a point.
He's not wrong. That's the problem with Fernando. He's not wrong. Last but not least, on the occasional segment of Does Somebody Still Have a Job? Mr. Charles Leclerc. Did he do a great race?
Yes, I think he did do a great race. Okay. He did just qualify, but he did a great race.
Because he pulled out, kept the tires going and didn't lose that many places?
Well, we'll say he pulled a Checo. Disappointing in qualifying and did a decent job coming back in the race.
Okay. So a good second driver then?
Yeah, I think he was a great second driver today. He didn't hold Carlos up when Carlos was coming through, but they were told they were good race.
My brain cannot process the team orders that went down in this race. And I can't even, we'll save that for a little.
Or lack of team orders, really.
Indeed, it was fascinating. What is this? I can't believe it. But, I add him on here just mostly because I feel like it's to remind me how I feel about the fact that Carlos is doing a great drive and they fired the wrong driver. So I feel like Charles should be on this list, but he signed up till 2028. So
good for Ferrari.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about qualification?
Sure. Since that's what we talk about next. It was quality. People drove fast laps.
Yep.
I think the best was after quali, and I'm not sure how much of it is a meme or just truth where, you know, Lewis is like, oh man, I don't know how we're still like a half second behind. Charles is like, I gave it everything. I couldn't find it. Max was like, yeah, I could have done more. That was fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Max is definitely in his peak Lewis phase right now where he doesn't have to try. And at some point in the next 2 years, he's going to have to dig deep and show how truly goatish he is. But yeah, it was qualifying. They went round and some cars and they did some stuff. And some people were out, some people were in. Blah-de-blah-de-blah, et cetera, et cetera.
We talked about like Lance not going through, which was...
Yeah. Lewis kind of...
Lewis George, outqualified George.
Yeah, which is unexpected. Didn't work for him, though.
Well... Bono, my strategy.
Bono, my strategy is gone. Was there even one in the first place to be gone? Shall we go on to recapping of the racing of the vehicles?
Oh, sure.
Number one, most important here, brilliant Red Bull Cherry Blossom hat. I would like to announce for listeners, I have been staying away from purchasing hats this year. As much as I would really like to buy hats, I'm trying to break my addiction to hats.
Yeah, but that's a good hat.
I know, but if I get just one hat, it's gonna open the floodgates. Because Mercedes have some cool rad yellow hats that they just announced this week, and there was a couple of McLaren ones, and if anybody wants to send me hats, please send in to feedback@tinfoilhelmets.com and I will help you deliver me a hat. But I'm trying very hard not to allow this to happen. So that was pretty good. And you know, in some respects,
Dominic, that one's limited edition.
I know, but if somebody clicks that button and sends it to me, it'd be quick. The only thing that was disappointing about that hat is I think they should have done it to the cars. The cars should have had that Japanese livery again.
Oh, that would have been good. But I like the moving of the Japanese Grand Prix to take place during a cherry blossom blooming. Sounds great.
Yeah, it worked. And I don't think it... I think the little bit of rain and the weather, I think, actually helped spice up the race a little bit too.
Yeah. And for those that don't know, in the Pacific Northwest, we also have cherry blossoms from Japan and they look great. So yeah, love seeing them.
I have got two in my own garden.
It's whoa. Great. We have one in a park just around the corner that is massive and looks so good this time of year.
It means you don't have to deal with the cherry blossom crap that gets sprinkled over your garden.
It's
the best way to do it. So, three corners and a red flag.
That's how long it took. I was surprised it went to a red flag, but seeing how much they just spewed tires everywhere. Yeah. Which, I was surprised at how lack of barrier protection there is right there.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at it in retrospect, because it looked pretty good, but Alex's car was buried pretty deep with most of the tires on top of his head.
And that was quite a convoy to go out and fetch the cars and repair the track.
Did you see the Transformer truck?
Yes.
It was amazing. It was great. I want one of those. Anyway, we alluded to it earlier, but we have concluded in our role as internet F1 stewards that the accident that caused Alex Albon and Daniel Ricciardo to swiftly exit before the completion of Sector 1 was, in fact, Alex's fault.
Yeah, I think so.
I think the way I phrased it is Alex made it happen, but Danny pulled the trigger.
I'm not sure there is much Danny could have done, because, like...
He was looking the wrong way!
All right, you're a Formula 1 driver. Yes. You have Lance Stroll on your left and Alex Albon on your right. Who are you looking at?
I'm looking at both of them, but I'm probably spending more attention on Stroll.
And where was he looking?
He was looking at Stroll, but he forgot the, I need to look a little bit the other way.
Maybe it was one of those, he like looked to the right to see, okay, Alex is back there. Look to the left, is Stroll going to dive bomb me? No, okay, I'm going to take the racing line, and didn't realize how much Alex had moved up.
Yeah, I think that's what really happened. But it sucks for both of them. I think in the weirdest way, I'm really sucks for Williams because I feel they're now doubly on a back foot. But
Was there any steward reporting from that? Did they look investigated after the race?
They did, and they concluded nobody was at fault. It was interesting. There was a comment that said that if this had happened on any other lap and that Stroll had not been there, they would have looked at this very differently, which I think is basically a rap on the back of the hand saying, like, don't do that again.
I mean, they tend to do that. Like, lap one, sector one incidents are usually judged a little differently than... Which, for right or wrong, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was interesting that they took the time to comment, though. I think that, for me, was the interesting point. Versus, like, I think that's what they do, but they kind of made, like, don't do it again, lads. So, yeah, that sucked. But, you know, there we go. I don't even think it spiced up the race a bit. Did make it a little bit later, but we got done and wrapped up before midnight, so I'll call that a win.
Well, it did spice up the race a little bit, because in the red flag period, Mercedes had the genius call to ditch the tires they started on and put on the hards in an attempt to do a one stop to the end hard.
And that worked perfectly for them.
No, it didn't. But yes.
Yeah, there we go. I still stand by my comment that it didn't really spice it up, because I don't think it didn't make anybody take what I would call the aggressive strategy. The strategies that they chose, those people that decided to do something different, actually chose, for want of a better word, a conservative strategy. Right, they didn't pick the, I'm going to put some soft tires on, I'm going to go nail this, and I'm just going to drive the wheels off this car. It's like, oh, we need you to pretend it's a Sunday drive. Just be careful, go around.
Well, the real loser in the when the timing of the red flag has to be Valtteri Bottas. I mean, where you got at least 10 minutes to do a pit stop, oh, they could have really benefited from that.
Yeah, and they might have been able to get all the wheels changed by that point.
Right.
Yeah.
Without cross-threading any wheel nuts.
Yeah, I can't believe they still haven't fixed them and we're in race four. And I know it's a difficult engineering problem, but please, people, really.
I mean, Valtteri did have a 4-second pit stop. That's huge.
Was that his only stop?
I think he stopped twice.
Yeah, it's difficult. Requires effort, and also it's Bottas and he didn't really get anywhere. He was driving a good weekend, and so I feel that was... it's an interesting take given the contracts renegotiations that are coming up. But
yeah, he's an interesting character because it's one where it's like... He is a very good Formula One driver, but it's also one of those, well, you had your chance in a top flight team and you didn't capitalize on it, so why do we want you in our team?
Yeah, other than as a good second driver.
Yeah.
Did you see him cycling along the motorway / busy road to the race or from the race? I can't remember which one it was.
No, it sounds nice, though.
Yeah, there was a video from motorsport.com. They were driving along in the car, and he was on the side of the road cycling along the hard shoulder on his bicycle, looking as chipper as a chipper thing can be. So it continues to feed into your belief that if he ever exits F1, he's going to become a gravel cyclist.
I mean, that's what all the retired pros do, straight to gravel cycling. Ferrari is actually good at the strategy.
I can't believe they did this. I can't believe they pulled it off. Let me be very specific. I can't believe they chose this, then executed on it successfully.
Yeah.
And it paid off. And then last, but finally not least, as we alluded to earlier, they didn't screw up with crazy team orders.
So in the precursor to the race, which I was watching a little bit of, they were talking about, like, some teams had kept two hards and a medium, some teams had kept two mediums and a hard. It really seemed like, despite the deg, the medium was the better tire to be on.
I think that was also spoken to by Lewis's pace at the very end of the race, where he was driving around faster than his teammate.
On a medium.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
But it also, like, I want to dig into this more later, but also really makes Mercedes look foolish in how they ran that race. But yeah, I mean, and then I guess the McLaren still have very high deg because, like, Lando was burning through mediums.
Yeah.
Like, Lando did two medium stints in the time it took Charles to do one medium stint.
Do you think that explains Piastri, who has improved his tire management but still isn't perfect, and that's why he was back a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. He also needed help from his new best friend, Fernando Alonso.
That was beautiful. I love Fernando.
I feel like that is just a little bit of like, hey, you know how we both screwed over Alpine? We're like best friends for life because of that.
Yeah, I think so. Fernando keeps doing this, and I think, because what was it? It was Carlos was doing this last year, right?
Carlos' strategy in Singapore to keep Lando close to prevent George. Why is George always on the back of these trains? Have you noticed that?
I know, it's very funny.
Yeah.
And every time he tries to do a lunge and screws up, luckily this time he didn't take out another driver.
That's because the walls are just so far away at Suzuka, like it would have been hard for him to hit a wall. Yes. Although Logan certainly tried at the Degnas.
He did, he tried, managed to get it out of it, though his teammate didn't hit it. And remember, Logan had already had his wall allotment allocation completed earlier in the weekend. He'd already hit it once.
I'm disappointed he didn't hit it hard enough, because that would have been the perfect timing for a late race safety car.
Oh, yeah. That would have spiced it up a little bit.
That would have really spiced it up. Like, good job, Logan, keeping it out of the wall. But it's one of those, like, did you ever see the old Buffalo Wild Wings commercials where people at, like, the wait staff at Buffalo Wild Wings have the ability to, like, call somebody to turn on a sprinkler or something, and it's like, oh man, I wish this game could keep going, and like they make a call and a sprinkler would come on, and it's like, oh, who could have seen that coming? Now we're going to overtime or something like that. And it's,
I'm gonna have to find this video and watch. I have never seen it.
Yeah, there were some good bits. I'll see if I can send you one. But yeah, I feel like the same sort of thing. It was, the race director just should have been like, Logan, you're not in the points, we'd like you to just stay there.
The only reason that they needed to make sure he could get out of it was because he needed to prove to everybody that he hadn't just broken the car again. And so to protect his life from getting back to the garage.
You beached it. You didn't break it. You just beached it.
True. 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 True.
Oh, I'm beached in the gravel.
Yeah. Yeah. He needs a magic button, that little race director, to compress it.
Yeah.
Just deflates the tires magically.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. So Ferrari did a good strategy. It was impressive. It gives me hope for Lewis next year.
Yeah, I agree.
So. Lance Stroll woes. We kind of talked about Lance and stuff.
That quote though was absolutely hilarious.
Which quote?
Of the it was a radio message. He was going down the front straight. It's like, there, I have no top end speed. This is, like, this car is so slow. Like,
he's finally learning something from Fernando.
Right. We had to talk about it at the top, and that was, it's almost a callback to the 2015 Japanese Grand Prix with Fernando's famous GP2 engine comment in front of the Honda engine makers, which. Yeah, hopefully some of us know the fallout from that.
I did not know it was actually at Suzuka when he had done this. I was fully aware of the quote, but not the wider context.
Yeah, it was at Suzuka where he did it. And then a couple years ago when he was racing Indy, and he was having like the worst time at the Indy 500 trying to do the Indy 500. And he, I think, could have gotten help from Andretti. And Andretti was ready to help him, but Andretti runs Honda engines, and Honda went, no, we're okay with not helping Fernando Alonso.
I think this speaks to the challenges and the slight ambiguity that Fernando and has had when he's trying to find a new seat, because I think his contract runs out this year, I believe, which is interesting, because you'd have thought Fernando would have been like filling all the holes, signing all the contracts, and that's why he's struggling to go to Red Bull, is there's enough people at Red Bull from Honda that clearly Red Bull must have hired for their engine. They're like, I'm not going to give the satisfaction, so he can't go to Red Bull. He doesn't want to go to Mercedes because it's a crap car, and it's going to be crap next year, and it's going to be crap in 2026. And he can't stay at Aston Martin because in 2026, Honda will take it over and they can't give it to him.
And like, to be fair in all this, like, I don't think Fernando's comments were unjustified in 2015. The problem was how public they were and where they were publicly. I think if he was like behind the scenes, it's like, guys, this is a much powerful GP2 engine. We need to do better. Here's some feedback. Here's where I feel it's lacking. I think they would have taken it in stride and moved forward. But like, man, saying that on the radio that you know is going to get broadcasted at the race, like, not a good look.
So here's a really interesting scenario for Fernando. And fits with everything that Fernando has ever done. Whenever Fernando gets stuck without a seat, he ends up back in a Renault. The question is when we get to 2026, because he'll find a seat for next year. I think that's not a problem. But I think he's only going to get a one-year contract. And I still think it might be Mercedes, because we've got to wait for Kimi. Is he going to end up back in a Renault again?
Yeah.
Because that would just be beautiful.
Maybe in the Clio Cup.
At this point, that would be faster than an Alpine.
Yeah. Oh, man. I want to talk about later, but like, the only other person who ran the same strategy as the Mercedes, the Alpines.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to Yuki being in the points?
Yuki was in the points, first Japanese driver in like 20 years or something, or 10 years.
10 years. And Marco was making lovely, lots of, you know, wistful, sweet nothings into his ear after all the media events, saying how great Yuki is and how Yuki is mature and stable and predictable and he's really good. And I find that fascinating. I'm trying to work out whether Helmut's doing it because he wants Yuki in the Red Bull. I'm still not sure Yuki's ready for that. Or whether he's doing it to make sure that Yuki gets a good seat somewhere by spit-talking him up.
You know, Yuki's really interesting because we talk about, like, oh, if Daniel can just beat Yuki, he goes into the Red Bull seat.
Right.
Oh, if Liam, you know, takes care of Yuki, he'll have the seat for next year, sort of thing. Meanwhile, Yuki's, like, matured into a pretty damn solid F1 driver. Like, that V-carb's not the best car, and he's routinely putting it either into Q3 or on the fringes of the points. Like, he's not doing, like, Red Bull has, the V-carb has 7 points this season. And all of those, they all come from Yuki.
Yeah, because the second driver's a bit crap. But here's the question about Yuki, though. Why is the narrative not a booster for Yuki? Like, what is it about Yuki? Is it that he's just been tainted with a screaming, sweary, petulant child? Is it because the implication when you really read between the lines is he wants to be a world-famous chef rather than an F1 driver? Like, why don't we have the narrative around Yuki being a great driver? Because he seems pretty good, and I think he just needs a better team. And I actually think he needs a teammate to push him in a better car. Like, he needs both a better car and a better driver, a better partner for him.
Well, Lance Stroll would be the best teammate.
Perfect.
Love it. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think there's probably definitely a little bit of like, oh, this guy doesn't want to be a world champion. Why do we want him in our top flight team? Because Yuki wants to be a chef. And I can't wait to go to Yuki's restaurant at Suzuka one day. It'll be so good.
So I've been watching all the seasons, and I've made it from 1970 something up to 1983. And it's been really interesting to watch that primary driver written in the contract. Of course, everybody's going to give up. And think about it in the context of most drivers today, where effectively every team is seemingly two primary drivers, right? Two drivers who are relatively closely pegged, at least on their best days. And they're all trying to end up, like, everybody's almost in it to win it for themselves. And I feel like teams are making a mistake in the context of having two great drivers, right? Maybe it's because they're all unknown entities and it's not clear which one's really better. But, like, Yuki, I think, would be a great example of, I think that he would, with a sufficiently large contract, could start his restaurant and would be a great second driver. Like, he would be a great, not a backup, like a spare driver, but like the driver who's going to sit there and drive really well and be up there and be competitive and be prepared to operate as the overtake roadblock for the other drivers. But most of these other teams seem to pick two drivers, even if one is clearly better than the other, and then operate them as independent drivers who could each succeed. And I don't really understand that.
Yeah, I wonder if, like, going back into, like, F1 history, I wonder if this is, like, fallout from, like, Schumacher breaking his leg.
Expand.
So, what was that, 99? When did Schumacher break his leg? Yeah, 99, British Grand Prix. So, what, Mika Häkkinen ended up winning it. But Michael was out for 7 rounds as his, well, DNS and then out 6 rounds because he broke his leg. Because in a big crash at Britain. And who was his teammate? Salo was his stand-in, Mika Salo. But Eddie Irvine was the second driver, and he finished second in the championship by 2 points. And looking at this, at the last race in Japan, Michael finished second, Eddie finished third. If Eddie had finished second, Eddie would have won, but Michael didn't want, like, he wanted to be the first Ferrari driver in forever to win the world title.
Right.
So, like, as a result, like, and, like, Eddie Irvine wasn't a bad driver, but he was clearly, like, second to Michael. And, like, I think he was far enough back that, like, Michael being out for those races, like, really put Eddie in with a shout. So I wonder if this is kind of fallout from that, from, like, yeah, Michael wanted to be the one to win for Ferrari, but Ferrari was like, we left a world champion on the table because we had a so-so second driver.
And therefore they play both drivers effectively independently to make sure that at least one of them gets it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But see, I feel in that situation, if you have your driver play as a second driver, they will always be right behind, right? And so they're always able to take over when they're equally pegged and they sit in that right place, and the stats will sort themselves out. I don't know. It feels strange and introduces more problem. Maybe all the spice has dropped out of F1 and they're all just really boring people. Like, where's the angry personality at each other?
Well, thank you for listening to Tinfoil Helmets. Our careers are over since the spice has gone from Formula One.
The spice must flow.
But also, like, Formula One cars are a lot more reliable today than they were, you know, years ago, to where, like, oh, Schumacher breaks his legs, that's fine, because Mika Hakkinen's engine's going to explode multiple times in the season, and it's gonna, and it'll all come out in the wash, sort of thing. And these days, because the cars are so reliable, if you want to pick up the points, you need another good driver who's not, it's not like, oh, well, we can just rely on our number one to pick up the points. The points also go a lot deeper, so it's better to have two good drivers than...
Yeah, and I think it's that you need two good drivers. It's just, I think, how you manage their expectations. I don't know. I suppose it's the fact that it's 20 drivers in the world are capable of doing this, and you can't get a bunch of people who's like, yeah, I'm happy being second. It's okay. You need them to be accepting of the fact that they want to be the best of the best.
Yeah, but like, Hülkenberg has a seat.
Yeah, because he likes getting paid, you know, $2 million a year and gets to fly around. It's great.
Sure, fair enough.
I wouldn't mind getting paid $2 million to drive around in an F1 car at the back of the grid.
Yeah, you don't have a super license.
I could get one.
But this is one of those, like, could you also land the airplane on the way there?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Perfect. Shall we talk about good guy Fernando?
We kind of did, but yeah, dragging Oscar around to help try to prevent George from getting by, and then Oscar screwed up and George goes by, and yeah.
And he qualified well. He got on top of the car when it was new. He said it was one of his best races ever afterwards.
Ever?
I think that's what the quote said, which is surprising. So
I saw the checkered flag and went to bed.
Oh, yeah, same here. Fernando is such an enigma.
It's not that much of an enigma. Just figure out what's the most self-serving way he can go and go that way.
Exactly, which is why he's going to be great when he's paired with George Russell.
That would be hilarious.
Exactly. Shall we spicily take some rumors?
Yeah, I think mostly I think Mercedes is regressing to where they belong.
That is extremely spicy, but I do not disagree with this statement.
It's hard to say that given the run of dominance they had from 2014 to 2020, depending on how you view Abu Dhabi 2021.
They won the eighth constructors. Like that's what they did. So.
It was quite a run of dominance, but going into that season, 2014. They had been kind of like where they are now in the previous formula of like, oh, they're in the points, but not like high in the points. And consistently in the points, but not high in the points. So it's interesting to see that. And now you come, they had a really great engine, which made them the class of the field. And we talked about how because they were so good for so long, because they had good engineering, that they didn't really do the best on strategy. They didn't really do the best on pit stops because they could get away with it because they just had the fastest car. And now we're kind of seeing this all come back around of, oh, they don't have the fastest car again, and they're terrible on strategy, and they're still terrible on pit stops.
Yeah, and here's the question. If that's the case, which again, I don't disagree with, why were they so successful for the, you know, previous regulatory era? Like, what was it that caused them to be successful? Sure, the engine was big and meaty and was great, but
that gives you like 2 or 3 years out of the eight.
Yeah, and even then you can't put a brilliant engine in the back of a terrible car. It, like,
no, that's not true. Williams got a podium in like 2014 several times because they had the Mercedes engine in that car,
right? And but that's the thing, they weren't dominant in that car,
right?
And so Mercedes were, so they got something right about the car. Right? Woe betide me for saying this, but like, yes, Lewis is, you know, a brilliant driver, but Nico was also successful, right? He was able to drag that car. And like,
well, we've talked about it before of like how much their data correlation is off, and we think it was just correlated in the perfect way for that formula. And then I think if the lesson to take from Mercedes is they got comfortable or they got complacent and they stopped, like, I think they ended up with a bit of a this is good enough mentality of because it was working. And it was like, oh, yeah, things are fine. The computer system is fine. We don't necessarily need to update it right now because it's correlating well. And now they're in a spot where nothing's correlating well. The car's not what they think it is. The first generation of their car with the zero side pods could very well end up being the most successful version in these regs that they get, because since they moved away from zero pods, they've gone backwards, which I don't necessarily think is their fault, because I think Ferrari and McLaren have also gone forward, and even Aston to some extent. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mentioned it earlier, but the only other team running the strategy they were on at Japan was Alpine, arguably the worst car on the grid. Not even arguably, the worst car on the grid.
Unquestionably the worst car on the grid.
When you are doing the same strategy as a team that's probably out there just mostly data collecting, you're doing it wrong.
Did you hear the two pieces of radio from Lewis? One was apparently before the race started, where he's like, are we sure? This was before they decided which tires they were definitely putting on the car. He was like, the track's 8 degrees higher. Does that still work with our strat? I'm not sure that really works with our strat. That's weird that this would work with our strat. And so he complained about that before they started. And then halfway through, after he was like slowly but surely sliding backwards, he was like, change the damn strategy. And then they're like, well, we're waiting for a gap. Suzuka is such an interesting track, because I think some people say you can't overtake, but I think there was a pretty reasonable amount of overtaking. It wasn't exciting overtaking, but there was overtaking. And I feel like if you believe in your driver, maybe that's the problem, they should just have said, okay, fine, let's do this thing. Let's try it. Let's do something different.
But I think that bleeds down to what Mercedes has been all along, is they trust like computer simulation more than the drivers. Like, how many times we can look back, I'm sure you'll get there on your rewatch, between like 2016 and 2020, of how many times Lewis was like, I'm not sure about this. And it's like, well, the computer says, and it's like, well, nope, Lewis was probably right on that one. But because the car was so dominant that you could just, well, trust what the computer says. And I remember I forget if they still post the debriefs, but they used to post like some debriefs on YouTube. And it was like, well, if we look at our simulations, everybody ended up right where we thought in our simulations. And it's, you know, going back to what an F1 lore, like Vettel's win in 2008 in Monza and the Toro Rosso, they were the only ones that seemed to look at the weather forecast of like, oh, sure, it's going to rain. Let's set up the car for rain.
There's a really interesting kind of like alternative universe here, which is people often say that Vettel and Fernando and Schumacher play the strategy from the driver's seat. Like they're strategizing, they're not just driving the car, they're strategizing. And people say, well, Lewis doesn't really do that. Is there a reality here that Lewis has actually been doing that for the last 8 years and the team just ignores him and has been able to, and it's projected the wrong thing, and when he's at Ferrari, he's going to be able to strategize from the seat and it's going to be amazing and it's going to be fantastic?
I mean, it could be, mate, but I think that leads into it, because, like, I mean, the joke for years is Bono my tires.
Secret code, though.
Yeah, but like Lewis was rarely ever happy with the tires and strategy. He's like, Bono my tires, fastest lap. And I think it's one of those cases of for a while I had a reef fish tank, and the joke always was, and this was like on like internet forums and stuff, of like, how come you never retest when you get the number you expect? You only retest when you get the number you don't expect.
Yes.
And it's the same thing. It's like, well, we're never going to look that. It's like, oh, well, the data prediction said we would win and we won. Great. Like,
no, you are 100% right. Everybody's excited and pats themselves on the back when the line goes up and is green, and you're like, great, and everybody gets very upset when it's red. Nobody says, why is it green? Is that what we expected? Do we understand why it's green?
Yeah, you don't recheck the result you expect.
Exactly, which I think is always a dangerous game to play.
Yeah, but it's like, well, this validated my expectations. We're good. Like, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think Mercedes is actually where they belong right now, and I don't know, maybe Toto's not the right guy going forward.
It's interesting. I was listening to this, BBC has this podcast called The Checkered Flag, which they normally do like race coverage on, but in the off season, they were allowed access to all the super secret parts of Mercedes and Williams. And they followed the build of the car from the end of the season. Like they started on day one after the end of the season, all the way up to the race. And it's interesting. And you can see, maybe this is why Toto and George get along. Every time Toto talks, he gives the political answer, right? It's a media managed. It's almost like his authentic self is not coming out in them. And I feel like that is an aspect of what you're talking about there, right? Like Toto may not be the best person because actually he's not thinking about it in the right way, or he's not really pouring himself into it. I don't know. It's not that I expect him to design the car, but I don't know. There's definitely something up there.
Say what you will about Christian Horner, but nobody's ever going to doubt that he is not passionate about that Red Bull team.
Oh, yeah. I agree. And to be fair, I actually feel the same about Fred Vasseur. Like, I think Fred Vasseur is in there and wants to fix the team, and he wants to be a great driver. And it's strange because...
Ross Brawn was the same way.
Yep. You can hear it actually in James Vowles. When you hear him talk about the team, he's occasionally full of platitudes and gives it a bit of business wishy-washy. But I actually think he's like, man, I'm going to, this Williams team, I'm going to turn it around. It's going to be amazing. I really care about being able to win, and it's going to be super interesting. And I think it's fascinating to hear the difference.
I think Zach Brown's also in that camp as well.
Yes, Zach Brown, I think, likes to collect drivers and sponsors. And I think he's in it to win it, but not necessarily. It's like it's in a different way that he's thinking about it. Like, but yes, I agree. But I don't think that's true about Alpine. I don't think that's true about what's his face at Sauber. I don't think that's true of Stijn Haas at all. There's another team I'm forgetting about, aren't there?
V-Carb.
Oh yeah, V-Carb. They're just there to be the creche for the drivers they want to put in the other seats.
Aston Martin.
They are not passionate about racing. They are passionate about winning.
I think they are passionate about the idea of racing, not the work that goes into racing.
Yes, yes, yes. I think
they have a very Steve McQueen doing Grand Prix. Steve McQueen in Grand Prix, or is that James Garner?
I have no
idea. They have a very like 1960s Hollywood view of Formula One.
Yeah,
the romantic side of racing.
Yes, but also no. Not quite the romantic. Like it's not the romanticism of the open road and the air flowing through your locks as you pass through over a perfect curve and you hit the apex and it's amazing. It's less about that aspect of it and more about the winning and I get to go to cool parties and all the other stuff, if that makes any sense.
It does. Oh, Steve McQueen was in Le Mans. James Garner was in Grand Prix. I have to get that right.
Interesting. Related to that, I watched... Ferrari, the one with Adam Driver in it.
Oh, how was that?
It was okay. It wasn't bad. There were some scenes in it that I'm like, those are hilarious special effects. And then I read the story behind the crash that happened. And you're like, oh, that looked like a ridiculous thing, but that's actually what happened.
Oh, that's terrible.
It was mildly terrifying. Yeah, but there was something missing from it. I feel like there was, it didn't, I mean, maybe this is the F1 fan in me. Like, I feel like it could have been half an hour longer. And covered a bit more of the machinations of the business related to racing. There was a bit of machinations related to the cars, but not really the racing. It was fascinating.
Well, I think sometimes, seeing your CGI crash come in, is I think sometimes like the CGI physics like just aren't right. Like I was watching the Masters of the Air series on Apple TV recently, and it's like, okay, the B-17s, they should like, if you go watch like Band of Brothers and like at the end of episode one, when the C-47s are taking off to go do the airborne drop on D-Day, they're using real C-17s and you can tell when they take off, like the wind starts to affect them and they wiggle a little bit. And then you watch like the CGI B-17s take off and they're on rails. Like, okay, there's no wiggle to them as they're going.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a little bit like that. So, but yeah.
Oh, I had one more spicy take and rumor.
Okay.
The reason Lance Stroll did such a terrible job this weekend is because Suzuka is a driver's track and Lance Stroll isn't a good driver.
Is that really spicy? Is that not continuing our narrative?
Okay, sure. But I just want to make sure I call it out because like all the drivers like love Suzuka because it's like it's such a driver's track and like it's so hard to get right. And I feel like it really exposed Lance Stroll this weekend.
Like every track every weekend?
This one more so.
Okay. This particularly exposed him.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's also the only figure of eight track on the calendar.
That's a great track, though. Very hard to drive in the games.
That is my favorite Suzuka stat, that it's the only figure of eight track.
That won't be true after we get the new Saudi track, though.
Is the Saudi track also a figure of eight?
I believe so. Also Madrid, because hasn't that got a crossover as well?
Okay, hang on. Now we got to fact check what we just said. New Saudi track.
Quid something or other? Quibi? Oh, no. Too close to home.
Yeah, but then it'll only be an eight-minute track. The race will be over too soon. It does not have a crossover. It doesn't look like it has a crossover.
Okay. Madrid?
Everything to know about F1. Well, the Madrid one has a roundabout. That's awesome.
But it's not a figure of eight?
No, it's not a figure of eight. It just has a roundabout.
Okay, well. Whatever. Should we move on to my spicy hot take?
Sure.
I think the new regs suck. And I'm going to say this in the strangest way. The cars are... This is not necessarily spicy itself, but the cars are too big, and this means drivers drive them conservatively. And if you reflect back on certainly the previous generation of cars, you can see them. They will go into corners, and they'll just wrench the car, and it will just go for all the ground effects, and you can go faster. It doesn't let the car driver drive the car like a crazy person. There is something about these new cars which just doesn't encourage it. And you can see this by watching the overtakes. Like, there are more overtakes, but they're not exciting overtakes. They're either like the car in front has screwed up its tires and it can't do it, and you just shoot past. You either didn't DRS past it. The only exception was Lando Norris in this race. Lando was doing a pretty good job, and he was like big cojones and did a great job. But we are...
Sergio chucked it up the inside of 130R. That was pretty good to watch.
Yes, and I think Lewis wussed out there. He should have held his line.
And then we could have all tumbled into the runoff into 130R.
Exactly.
Which does not look like enough runoff nor barrier.
No, and it would have definitely been a red flag. But there's something about these new cars that just doesn't lend themselves to the spicy overtake. And I think it is a combination of being heavy, and I think it's a combination of the brakes being restricted and all the cooling that you can do for it, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And I'm really hoping they fix this in 2026. But I think it's like, to your point about the green versus red and investigation when your expectations match what it is and you don't do it, there is an aspect of, I think, everything that they set out to do with this regs was satisfied. It does lead to, I think, more overtakes. But it's not, it is never the number of overtakes. It's the quality and the skill required to execute those overtakes.
Hey, at least we have overtakes.
Yeah, but like even in 2020, where Mercedes was dominated with like the best car ever made, I still feel that there were fewer overtakes, but when they happened, they were good overtakes. Like, people took the... Here for me is a great example, right? You get stuck behind the other car and you have to strategize while you're going around and around and around and around and around. And then you find exactly the right place and you try it a few times. And nobody seems to be doing that. Not this season and not last season. And I think that like makes it boring. It's not... F1 has a problem because it's boring because of Max, and we need to fix that. But the second aspect is, even if he was closer, I'm not sure you'd be getting the spicy overtakes.
Sure. But like, this is very hard for me to believe coming back from... I want to say the 2019 French Grand Prix.
Mm-hmm.
That was just so boring because nobody could do any overtaking.
But I think that was a byproduct of the track.
That's true, too. That was a bad track. But it was also just like, I remember watching that race and like, did anything happen?
No. Nothing ever happens in that track.
It's so sad that there's like 108 different variations on Paul Ricard and they picked the one that sucks.
And they can't find a good one. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and you can't find one that there's good racing. There's only 108 different options. One of these should produce a good one.
You'd hope. They should try that. They should try that. And that's what they should do in FP1 and FP2. They should just change the track every 20 minutes and see whether you can find an exciting combination.
What if every lap had a different layout at Paul Ricard?
Yes, this is perfect. And rain.
Yeah.
Which you could bet on.
We just have sprinklers going off on one section of the track. So, like, only one bit's wet. So you have to, like, nurse your slick tires through the wet bit, like, through one sector every track. This is great.
And it moves throughout the race.
Doesn't Paul Ricard actually have a, like, sprinkler system because they do, like, Le Mans testing? Exactly. That's awesome.
Exactly. Shall we try and predict the future?
I mean, we haven't yet, so why start now?
Okay, great. I have one prediction for China. It's important to remember China is a sprint race. It is also a track that the old drivers on the thing have driven it, but most of the new drivers haven't driven China, and they've only got one FP1 session. It's gonna be spicy.
All right, I'll say there's gonna be a good crash in the turn 1, 2, 3 snail complex.
Yes, and that will be one of the Williams, and it will be during the sprint race, and it will cause the car not to participate in the race.
You're just really down on Williams right now. Is it their spreadsheet?
No, I appreciate the fact that they continue to pay for an Excel subscription so that I can remain employed.
If you work on Excel, I'm so sorry for you.
I don't work on Excel, but I love it. Excel is the second best solution to any problem.
What's the first?
The real solution for the real problem that's most appropriate in the context. But if all else fails, just slap it into Excel. It'll be fine.
I feel like we should just say real quick, it's just a PSA to anybody out there listening. Excel is not a database. Let's move on. Yeah.
I also have one other prediction. Because it's only at 1FP1, it will be Merc down the back because their car, they have no idea what's going on.
I will say it is also going to be the first non-1-2 finish in the Grand Prix this year.
Plausible.
Yeah.
Plausible. What's your particular reasoning behind that?
Hot hand fallacy, the streak can't go on.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, just try and do something. And also, like, okay. Seeing somebody split either the Red Bulls would be nice, because I assume Max is just going to go lollygag off into the distance again.
Has Lando ever driven in China?
Yes.
Okay.
I assume so. He was in Formula One in, like, 2019, wasn't he?
Let's check. Is that the last time we...
Let's see. Lewis, Bottas, Verstappen, Leclerc, Sainz, Gasly... Albon, Ricardo, Perez, Norris, that's 10. Hulkenberg, Stroll, K-Mag, Russell. So only 6 drivers haven't driven China.
Logan, Piastri.
Joe.
Well, surely he's driven that track.
Not in an F1 car. Not
True.
Officially in an F1 car.
True.
So that'll be cool. Do you want any predictions for his home race?
He's in the Sauber. He will be sitting around at the back and out qualified by Bottas.
At this point, I think finishing would be a bold prediction for that Sauber.
Yes.
But if you want to contribute to our show notes, we are awaiting your feedback at feedback@tinfoilhelmets.com. And let us know your conspiracies, feedbacks, wants, desires, dreams, life goals. And also tell your friends to please like, listen, rate, and subscribe. We'll be back in 2 weeks for the Chinese Grand Prix.
With a sprint.
It is 2 weeks, right?
We're
doing great at the calendar this year.
Yeah.